personal interest in seeing the company succeed. Also, in some cases, multiple layers of management separate the senior executives from what's really going on at the customer level. And in a capitalist economy, the ultimate boss in a company is the customer. Times are changing at an ever faster rate. A company with a hot new product today will find sales slipping within 2 or 3 years if it doesn't continue to bring relevant new products to market. Most new products, services, and inventions come from young, hungry, innovative, small and medium-sized companies with entrepreneurial management. Not coincidentally, these organizations grow much faster and create most of the new jobs. Many are in the service or technology industries. This is where the great future growth of America lies. Microsoft, Cisco Systems, and Oracle are just a few examples of dynamic small-cap innovators of the 1980s and 1990s that continually grew and became big-cap stocks. In contrast, if a mammoth older company creates an important new product, it may not materially help its stock because the product will probably account for only a small percentage of the company's total sales and earnings. The product is simply a small drop in a bucket that's just too big. From time to time, companies make the mistake of excessively splitting their stocks. This is sometimes done on advice from Wall Street investment bankers. In my opinion, it's usually better for a company to split its shares 2-for-1 or 3-for-2 than 3-for-1 or 5-for-1. When a stock splits 2-for-1, you get 2 shares for each share previously held, but the new shares sell for half the price. Oversized splits create a substantially larger supply and may put a company in the more lethargic big cap status sooner. It may be unwise for a company whose stock has gone up in price for a year or two to declare an extravagant split near the end of a bull market or in the early stage of a bear market. Yet, this is exactly what many corporations do. Generally speaking, these companies feel the lower-priced stock will attract more buyers. This may be the case with some smaller buyers, but it also may produce the opposite result, more sellers, especially if it's the second split in the last year or two. Knowledgeable pros and a few shrewd individual traders will probably use the excitement generated by the oversized split as an opportunity to sell and take their profits. A stock will often top in price around the second or third time it splits. Our study of the biggest winners found only 18% of them had splits in the year preceding their great price advances. Large holders who are thinking of selling might figure it's easier to unload their 100,000 shares before a 3-for-1 split than sell 300,000 shares afterward. And smart short sellers pick on stocks that are heavily owned by institutions and starting to falter after huge price run-ups. In most, but not all cases, it's usually a good sign when a company, and especially a small to medium-sized growth company that meets the can-slim criteria, buys its own stock in the open marketplace over a consistent period of time. A 10% buyback would be considered big. This reduces the number of shares in the marketplace and usually implies the company expects improved sales and earnings in the future. As a result of the buyback, the company's net income will be divided by a smaller number of shares, thereby increasing earnings per share. As we've discussed, the percentage increase in earnings per share is one of the principal driving forces behind outstanding stocks. From the mid-1970s to the early 1980s, Tandy, Teledyne, and Metro Media successfully repurchased their own stock. All three produced notable results in their earnings per share growth and in the price advance of their stock. Tandy's split-adjusted stock increased from $2.75 to $60 between 1973 and 1983. Teledyne stock zoomed from $8 to $190 from 1971 to 1984. And Metro Media soared from $30 to $560 from 1971 to 1977. Teledyne shrank its capitalization from 88 million shares to 15 million and increased its earnings from 61 cents a share to nearly $20 per share with 8 separate buybacks. In 1989 and 1990, International Game Technology announced they were buying back 20% of their stock. By September 1993, IGT had advanced more than 20 times. NVR, Incorporated, had big buybacks in 2001. After you found a stock with a reasonable number of shares, check the percentage of the company's total capitalization represented by long-term debt or bonds. Usually, the lower the debt ratio, the safer and better the company. Earnings per share of companies with high debt-to-equity ratios could be clobbered in difficult periods of high interest rates. These highly leveraged companies are generally of lower quality and higher risk. A corporation that's been reducing its debt as a percent of equity over the last 2 or 3 years is worth considering. If nothing else, interest costs will be sharply reduced, helping generate higher earnings per share. Additionally, the presence of convertible bonds in the capital structure could dilute earnings if and when the bonds are converted into shares of common stock. The best way to measure a stock's supply and demand is by watching its daily trading volume. When a stock pulls back in price, you want to see volume dry up, indicating no significant selling pressure. When it rallies up in price, you want to see volume rise, which usually represents institutional buying. When a stock breaks out of a price consolidation area, trading volume should be at least 50% above normal. In many cases, it will increase 100% or more for the day, indicating solid buying of the stock and the possibility for further increases in price. Using daily and weekly charts helps you analyze and interpret a stock's price and volume action. Remember, any size capitalization stock can be bought under the CAN-SLIM method, but small-cap stocks will be substantially more volatile, both on the upside and the downside. From time to time, the market will shift its emphasis from small to large caps and vice versa. Companies buying back their stock in the open market and companies showing stock ownership by management are preferred. Chapter 5. L equals leader or laggard. Which is your stock? People tend to buy stocks they like, stocks they feel good about, or stocks they feel comfortable with. But in an otherwise exciting stock market, these sentimental securities often lag the market rather than lead it. Suppose you want to buy a stock in the computer industry. If you buy the leader in the group, and if your timing is right, you have a crack at real price appreciation. But if you buy a stock that hasn't yet moved, or is down the most in price, because you feel safer with it and think you're getting a real bargain, you might have bought a stock with little upward price potential. Why else would it be at the bottom of the pile? Don't just dabble in stocks. Dig in, do some detective work, and find out what really works. The top 2 or 3 stocks in a strong industry group can have unbelievable growth, while others in the pack may hardly stir. In 1979 and 1980, Wang Labs, Prime Computer, Datapoint, Rome Corporation, Tandy Corporation, and other small computer companies had 5, 6, and 7-fold advances before topping and retreating. Grand old IBM, on the other hand, just sat there, and giants Burroughs, NCR, and Sperry Rand turned in lifeless performances. However, in the next bull market cycle, IBM sprang to life and produced excellent results. Home Depot advanced 10 times from 1988 to 1992, while Wabin and Hechinger, the group's laggards, dramatically underperformed. You should buy the really great companies, the ones that lead their industries and are number one in their particular field. All of my best big winners, Syntex in 1963, Pick and Save from 1976 to 1983, Price Company from 1982 to 1985, Franklin Resources from 1985 to 1986, Genentech from 1986 to 1987, Amgen from 1990 to 1991, America Online from 1998 to 1999, Charles Schwab from 1998 to 1999, Sun Microsystems from 1998 to 1999, and Qualcomm in 1999, were the number one companies in their industries at the time they were purchased. The number one market leader is not the largest company or the one with the most recognized brand name. It's the one with the best quarterly and annual earnings growth, return on equity, profit margins, sales growth, and price action. It will also have a superior product or service and be gaining market share from its older, less innovative competitors. As our studies show, very little in the stock market is really new. History just keeps repeating itself. In the summer of 1963, I bought stock in Syntex, the developer of the birth control pill, which then shot up 400%. Most people wouldn't buy it, because it had just made a new price high at $100, and its P.E. ratio, at 45, seemed too high. Instead, several investment firms recommended G.D. Searle as a sympathy play. It looked much cheaper in price and had a product similar to Syntex's, but it failed to produce the same market results. Syntex was the leader, Searle the laggard. A sympathy play is a stock in the same group as a leading company, and it's bought in the hope that the leader's luster will rub off onto it. But the profit and price records of sympathy plays usually pale in comparison. Eventually, they'll try to move up in sympathy with the real leader, but they never do as well. In 1970, Levitt's Furniture, the leader in the then-new warehouse business, became an electrifying market winner. Wix Corporation copied Levitt's, and many people bought its shares because they were cheaper in price. But Wix never performed and ultimately got into financial trouble. Levitt's, meanwhile, appreciated 900% before it finally topped. As steel industry pioneer Andrew Carnegie said in his autobiography, "The first man gets the oyster, the second the shell." If you own a portfolio of stocks, you must learn to sell the worst performers first and keep the best ones a little longer. In other words, always sell your losers and mistakes and watch your better selections to see if they progress into your big winners. There's a fast and easy way to tell if your stock is a leader or a laggard. Check IBD's Relative Price Strength, RS rating. The RS rating is defined as a proprietary rating that measures the price performance of a given stock against the rest of the market for the past 52 weeks. Each stock is assigned a performance rating from 1 to 99, with 99 being best. An RS rating of 99 means the stock has outperformed 99% of all other companies in terms of price performance. If your stock's RS rating is below 70, it's lagging the better performing stocks in the overall market. That doesn't mean it can't go up in price. It just means that if by some chance it does go up, it'll probably go up less. The average RS rating of the best performing stocks each year from the early 1950s through 2000 was 87 before their major run-ups. So the determined winner's rule, avoid laggard stocks and sympathy moves. Look for the genuine leaders. The relative price strength rating is shown each day for all New York Stock Exchange, NASDAQ, and Amex stocks listed in Investor's Business Daily's stock tables. You can't find this information in any other newspaper. Updated RS ratings are also shown on the Daily Graphs online charting service. In addition to IBD's proprietary RS rating, you'll also want to look on a chart for the relative strength line. If it has been sinking for 7 months or more, or if the line has an abnormally sharp decline for 4 months or more, the stock's price behavior is highly questionable. Want to upgrade your stock selection and concentrate on the best leaders? Restrict your purchases to companies showing a relative price strength rating of 80 or higher. There's no point to buying a stock that's straggling behind many others in the market, yet that's exactly what many investors do. Most do it without ever looking at a relative strength line or RS rating, including some of America's largest investment firms. I don't like to buy stocks with relative price strength ratings less than 80. In fact, the really big money-making selections generally have RS ratings of 90 or higher just before breaking out of their first or second base structure. The RS rating of a potential winning stock should be in the same league as a pitcher's fastball. The average big league fastball is clocked about 86 miles per hour, and the best pitchers throw heat in the 90s. When you buy, make absolutely sure the stock is coming out of a sound base, price consolidation area, and that you buy it at its exact pivot buy point. Also, be sure it's not extended more than 5% or 10% above the precise buy point of this base. This will keep you from chasing stocks that have raced up in price too rapidly above their bases. Buying stocks that are extended percentage-wise too far from a correct buy point will result in more sharp sell-offs in price that will shake you out of a stock. The unwillingness of investors to set and follow minimum standards for stock selection reminds me of doctors years ago who were ignorant of the need to sterilize their instruments before each operation. They kept killing off patients until surgeons finally and begrudgingly accepted studies by researchers Louis Pasteur and Joseph Lister. Ignorance rarely pays off in any walk of life, and it's no different in the stock market. Corrections, or price declines, in the general market can help you recognize new leaders if you know what to look for. The more desirable growth stocks normally correct 1.5 to 2.5 times the general market averages. In a bull market correction, growth stocks declining the least percentage-wise are usually your best selections. The stocks that drop the most are normally your weakest. Say the general market average suffers an intermediate-term correction of 10%, and three of your successful growth stocks come off 15%, 20%, and 30%. The two off only 15% or 20% are likely to be your best investments after they recover. A stock sliding 35% to 40% in a general market decline of 10% could be flashing a warning signal. In most cases, you should heed it. Once a general market decline is definitely over, the first stocks that bounce back to new price highs are almost always your authentic leaders. These breakouts continue week by week for about 3 months. Many professional investment managers make the serious mistake of buying stocks that have just suffered unusually large price drops. As our studies indicate, this is a surefire way to get yourself in trouble. In June 1972, a normally capable institutional investor in Maryland bought Levitt's Furniture after its first abnormal price break, a one-week drop from $60 to around $40. The stock rallied for a few weeks, rolled over, and broke to $18. In October 1978, several institutional investors bought Memorex when it had its first unusual price break. It later plunged. In September 1981, certain money managers in New York bought Dome Petroleum on a break from $16 to $12. To them, it seemed cheap, and there was a favorable story about the stock going around Wall Street. Months later, Dome sold for $1. Institutional buyers snapped up Lucent Technologies at the start of 2000 when it broke from $78 to $50. Later in the year, it collapsed to $5. None of these pros recognized the difference between normal price declines and highly abnormal, big-volume corrections that signal potential disaster. The real problem, of course, was these experts all relied solely on fundamental analysis and stories and their personal opinion of value, lower P.E. ratios. They didn't pay attention to the market action that could have told them what was really going on. Those who ignore what the market says usually pay a heavy price. Those who listen and who learn the difference between normal and abnormal action are said to have a good feel for the market. In the spring of 1967, I remember walking through a broker's office in New York on a day when the Dow Jones Industrial Average was down over 12 points. 12 points was a lot in those days. When I looked up at the electronic ticker tape showing prices moving across the wall, I saw that Control Data was trading at $62, up 3.5 points on heavy volume. I bought the stock at once. I knew Control Data well, and this was abnormal strength in the face of a weak overall market. The stock later ran up to $150. In April 1981, just as the 1981 bear market was getting underway, MCI Communications, a Washington, D.C.-based telecommunications stock, trading in the over-the-counter market, broke out of a price base at $15. It advanced to the equivalent of $90 in 21 months. This was another great example of abnormal strength during a weak market. Lorillard did the same thing in the 1957 bear market. Software Toolworks soared in the down market of early 1990. In 1999, Qualcomm made big progress even during its difficult mid-year market, and Taro Pharmaceuticals soared in the last part of 2000. So don't forget, it seldom pays to invest in laggard stocks, even if they look tantalizingly cheap. Look for and confine your purchases to market leaders. Chapter 6. I equals institutional sponsorship. Follow the leaders. It takes big demand to move prices up, and by far the largest source of big demand for stocks is institutional investors, mutual funds, pension funds, banks, etc., who account for the lion's share of each day's market activity. What is institutional sponsorship? Institutional sponsorship refers to the shares of a stock owned by institutions, such as mutual funds, corporate pension funds, insurance companies, large investment counselors, hedge funds, bank trust departments, and state, charitable, and educational institutions. For measurement purposes, I do not consider brokerage research reports or analyst recommendations as institutional sponsorship, although a few may exert strictly short-term influence on some securities. Investment advisory services and market newsletters also aren't considered to be institutional or professional sponsorship by this definition, because they lack the concentrated or sustained buying or selling power of institutional investors. A winning stock doesn't need a huge number of institutional owners, but it should have at least several. 10 might be a minimum reasonable number of institutional sponsors, although most stocks have a good many more. If a stock has no professional sponsorship, chances are that its performance will be more run-of-the-mill. Odds are that at least several of more than 1,000 institutional investors have looked at the stock and passed it over. Even if they're wrong, it still takes large buying volume to stimulate an important price increase. Diligent investors go yet another level deeper. They want to know not only how many institutional sponsors a stock has, and if that number has increased in recent quarters, but they also want to know who those sponsors are. They look for stocks held by at least one or two of the more savvy portfolio managers who have the best performance records. This is referred to as analyzing the quality of sponsorship. When analyzing the quality of a stock's sponsorship, the latest 12 months plus the last three-year period of performance of an institutional sponsor are usually the most relevant. One quick and easy way to do this is by checking a fund's 36-month performance rating in Investor's Business Daily. An A-plus rating indicates a fund in the top 5% of all funds in terms of performance. Funds with ratings of A-minus or higher are considered your better performers. However, results may change significantly as key portfolio managers leave one money management firm and go to another. The institutional leaders continually rotate and change. For example, until 1981, the Trust Investment Division of California-based Security Pacific Bank, since merged into Bank of America, enjoyed only modest success, but with the addition of new management and the introduction of more realistic investing concepts, it polished up its act to the point it ranked at the very top in performance in 1982. In 1984, Security Pacific's top manager left and formed his own company, Nicholas Applegate of San Diego, California, which, from its start, has been one of William O'Neill and Company's, our institutional services firm, major clients. Financial services such as Vickers and Weisenberger Thompson Financial publish fund holdings and investment performance records of various institutions. In the past, mutual funds tended to be more aggressive in the market, but banks also manage large amounts of money. More recently, many new entrepreneurial-type investment counseling firms have cropped up to manage institutional monies. As mentioned previously, it's less crucial to know how many institutions own a stock than which of the better-performing institutions own or have bought a stock recently. It's also key to know if the total number of sponsors is increasing or decreasing. The main thing to look for is the recent quarterly trend. It's always best to buy stocks showing an increasing number of institutional owners over several recent quarters. You can also get an overall picture of a stock's sponsorship using Investor's Business Daily's proprietary sponsorship rating found in the stock tables. It ranges from A, best, to E, worst. Stocks with an A rating indicate increased buying by the better money managers in the market. A significant new institutional investment position taken in the most recently reported period is generally more relevant than existing positions held for some time. This is because when a fund establishes a new position, chances are that it will continue to add to that position and may be less likely to sell it in the near future. Reports on such activities, which are available about 6 weeks after the end of a fund's quarter or six-month period, are very helpful to those who can identify the wiser picks and to understand correct timing and the proper analysis of daily and weekly charts. Many investors feel disclosure of a fund's new commitments are published too long after the fact to be of any real value. This is really not true. Institutional trades also tend to show up on the ticker tape in transactions from 1,000 to 100,000 shares or more. Institutional buying and selling account for more than 70% of the activity in most leading companies. This is the sustained force behind most important price moves. It's important to note that about half the institutional buying that shows up on the New York Stock Exchange ticker tape may be in humdrum stocks. Much of it may also be wrong. But out of the other half, you may have some truly phenomenal selections. Your task, then, is to separate intelligent, highly informed institutional buying from poor, faulty buying. Though difficult, this will become easier as you learn to apply and follow the proven rules, guidelines, and principles presented in this book. To gain a better sense for what works in the market, it's important to study the investment strategies of well-managed mutual funds. When reviewing Investor's Business Daily's mutual fund tables, look for funds with A ratings, and then call to obtain a prospectus. In doing so, you'll learn the investment philosophy and techniques used by certain funds. It is possible for a stock to have too much sponsorship. Over-owned is a term we coined in 1969 to describe stocks whose institutional ownership had become excessive. The danger is that excessive sponsorship might translate into large potential selling if something goes wrong at the company or a bear market begins. Janus Funds alone owned more than 250 million shares of Nokia and 100 million shares of America Online that contributed to an adverse supply-demand imbalance in 2000 and 2001. WorldCom, in 1999, and JDSU, Nokia, and Cisco Systems in 2000 and 2001 were examples of overowned stocks. Thus, the favorite 50 and other widely owned institutional stocks can be rather poor, potentially risky prospects. By the time a company's attractive performance is so obvious that almost all institutions own the stock, it's probably too late to climb aboard. The heart is already out of the watermelon. For instance, stocks such as America Online in the summer of 2001 and Cisco Systems in the summer of 2000 are examples of those that were overowned by more than 1,000 institutions. This potential heavy supply can adversely affect a stock during bear market periods. While it may seem like some stocks are invincible, the old saying is true: what goes up must eventually come down. No company is immune forever from management problems, economic slowdowns, and changes in market direction. The savvy investor knows that in the stock market, there are few sacred cows. For instance, in June 1974, no one could believe it when William O'Neill and Company put Xerox on its institutional sell list at $115. Xerox was then one of the most widely held institutional stocks, and had been amazingly successful up to that point, but our research indicated it had topped and was headed down. It was also overowned. However, institutional investors went on to make Xerox their most widely purchased stock for that year. When the stock tumbled in price, it showed the true condition of the company at that time. The episode did bring widespread attention to our institutional services firm and our first global insurance company account, American International Group, AIG, in New York City. The company had been buying Xerox on the way down in the 80s, until we persuaded them they should be selling instead of buying. We also received a lot of argument in 1998 when we put Gillette, another sacred cow, on our avoid list near $60 before it tanked. Enron was removed from our buy list on November 29, 2000, at $72.91 due to its poor action. Another benefit to you as an individual investor is that institutional sponsorship provides buying support when you want to get out of your investment. If there's no sponsorship and you try to sell your stock in a poor market, you may have problems finding someone to buy it. Daily marketability is one of the tremendous advantages of owning stock in the United States. Real estate is far less liquid, and commissions and fees are much higher. Institutional sponsorship provides continuous liquidity. In summary, only buy stocks that have at least a few institutional sponsors with better-than-average recent performance records, and invest in stocks showing an increasing total number of institutional owners in recent quarters. Utilize institutional sponsorship, and always make it an extremely important tool as you research a stock for purchase. Chapter 7. M equals Market Direction, How to Determine It. You can be right on every one of the factors in the first six chapters, but if you're wrong about the direction of the general market, three out of four of your stocks will plummet with the market averages, and you will certainly lose money big time, as many people did in 2000. Therefore, in your analytical toolkit, you absolutely must have a reliable method to determine if you're in a bull, up market, or a bear, down market. But that's not enough. If you're in a bull market, are you in the early stage or the latter stage? And more importantly, what is the market doing right now? Is it weak and acting badly, or is it merely going through a normal decline, typically 8% to 12%? Is the market doing just what it should be, based on current conditions in the country, or is it acting abnormally strong or weak? In order to answer these and other vital questions, you'll want to learn to analyze the overall market correctly, and you must start at the most logical point. The best way to determine the direction of the market is to follow, interpret, and understand what the general market averages are doing every day. It might sound overwhelming at first, but with patience and practice, you'll soon be analyzing the market like a pro. This is the most important lesson you can learn. Remember, don't let anyone tell you that you can't time the market. We've heard from thousands of readers of this chapter and IBD's The Big Picture column who have done just that. As a result, they had the foresight to sell stocks and raise cash in March 2000, protecting much of their gains made during 1998 to 1999. The erroneous belief that no one can time the market evolved more than 30 years ago, when most mutual funds that tried it weren't successful at it. This is because they had to both sell exactly right and then get back in the market at exactly the right time, but due to their asset size problems, it took weeks to raise cash and weeks to re-enter the market. Funds lost relative performance during the fast turnarounds that frequently happen at market bottoms, called the bounce-back effect. Therefore, the top management at these mutual funds imposed rules on their money managers that required them to remain fully invested, 95% to 100% of assets. This fits well with the sound concept that mutual funds are truly long-term investments. Also, because funds are typically widely diversified, owning 100 or more stocks spread among many industries, in time, they will recover as the market recovers. What is the general market? The general market is a term that usually refers to the most commonly used market indices. These indices tell you the approximate strength or weakness in each day's overall trading activity and can be one of your earliest indications of emerging trends. These indices include the Standard & Poor's S&P 500. Consisting of 500 companies, this index is a broader, more modern representation of market action than the Dow. New York Stock Exchange-traded stocks are featured prominently in this index, as opposed to stocks traded on the American Stock Exchange and the NASDAQ, which are featured less prominently. The Dow Jones Industrial Average, DJIA. This index consists of 30 widely traded stocks, and while it used to focus primarily on large, cyclical industrial issues, it has broadened a little in recent years to include companies like Coca-Cola and Home Depot. It's a simple but rather out-of-date average to study because it's dominated by established, old-line companies that grow more slowly than today's more modern, entrepreneurial companies. Also, its 30 stocks can be more easily manipulated over short time periods. The NASDAQ Composite. The more relevant and volatile index in recent years, the NASDAQ is home to the market's younger, more innovative, and fast-growing companies. It includes over 4,000 companies that trade via the NASDAQ network of market makers, and it is more heavily weighted toward the technology sector. Why is skilled, careful market observation so important? A Harvard professor once asked his students to do a special report on fish. His scholars went to the library, read books about fish, and then wrote their expositions. The students were shocked when, after turning in their papers, the professor tore them up and threw them in the wastebasket. When they asked what was wrong with the reports, the professor said, "If you want to learn anything about fish, sit in front of a fishbowl and look at fish." He then made his students sit and watch fish for hours. Then they rewrote their assignment solely on their observations of the objects themselves. Being a student of the market is like being a student in this professor's class. If you want to learn about the market, you must observe and study the major indices carefully. In doing so, you'll come to recognize meaningful changes in the daily market average's behavior at key turning points, like market tops and bottoms, and learn to capitalize upon them. Recognizing when the market has hit a top or has bottomed out is frequently 50% of the whole complicated ballgame. It's also the key investing skill virtually all amateur and professional investors alike seem to lack. In fact, Wall Street analysts completely missed calling the market top in 2000, particularly the top in every one of the high technology leaders. The stages of a stock market cycle. The winning investor should understand how a normal business cycle unfolds and over what period of time. Particular attention should be paid to recent cycles. There's no guarantee that just because cycles lasted 3 or 4 years in the past, they'll last that long in the future. Bull and bear markets don't end easily. It usually takes 2 or 3 pullbacks to fake out or shake out the few remaining speculators. After everyone who can be run in or run out has thrown in the towel, there isn't anyone left to take action in the same direction. Then the market will finally turn and begin a whole new trend. Bear markets usually end while business is still in a downtrend. The reason is that stocks are anticipating or discounting economic events months in advance. Similarly, bull markets usually top out and turn down before a recession sets in. For this reason, use of economic indicators to tell you when to buy or sell stocks is not recommended. Yet some investment firms do this very thing. The predictions of many economists also leave a lot to be desired. A few of our nation's presidents have had to learn this lesson the hard way. In early 1983, just as the economy was in its first few months of recovery, the head of President Reagan's Council of Economic Advisers was a little concerned. The capital goods sector was not very strong, he fretted. This was the first hint that this advisor might not be as sound as he should be. Had he understood historical trends, he would have seen that capital goods demand had never been strong in the early stage of recovery, especially in the first quarter of 1983, when U.S. plants were operating at a low percentage of capacity. You should check earlier cycles to learn the sequence of industry group moves at various stages of the market. For example, railroad equipment, machinery, and other capital goods industries are late movers in a business or stock market cycle. This knowledge can help you get a fix on where you are now. When these groups start running up, you know you're near the end. In early 2000, it was computer companies supplying internet, capital goods, and infrastructure that were the last stage movers, along with telecommunications equipment suppliers. Dedicated market students who want to learn more about cycles and the longer-term history of U.S. economic growth may want to write to Securities Research Company, 101 Prescott Street, Wellesley Hills, Massachusetts, 02481, and purchase one of their long-term wall charts. Some charts of market averages include major news events over the last 12 months. These can be very valuable, especially if you keep and review back copies. You then have a history of both the market averages and events that have influenced their direction. It helps to know, for example, how the market has reacted to new faces in the White House, rumors of war, controls on wages and prices, changes in discount rates, or just to panics in general. Study the general market every day. In bear markets, stocks usually open strong and close weak. In bull markets, they tend to open weak and close strong. The general market averages need to be studied closely every day, since reverses in trends can begin on any given day. Relying on these primary indices is a much more practical and effective method for analyzing the market's behavior and determining its direction. Don't rely on other subsidiary indicators because they haven't been proven as effective. Listening to the many market newsletter writers, technical analysts, or strategists who pore over 30 different technical or economic indicators and then tell you what they think the market should be doing is generally a waste of time. Investment newsletters can create doubt, uncertainty, and confusion in an investor's mind. Interestingly enough, history shows that the market tends to go up just when these experts are most skeptical and uncertain. You must sell when the general market tops to raise at least some cash, as well as get off margin, using borrowed money, in order to protect your account. As an individual investor, you can easily raise cash and get out in 1 or 2 days, and can likewise re-enter later when the market is right. If you don't sell and raise cash when the general market tops, your diversified list of former market leaders can decline sharply, and several may never recover to former levels. Your best bet is to learn to interpret daily price and volume charts of the key general market averages. If you do, you can't get too far off track, and you won't need much else. It doesn't pay to argue with the market. Experience teaches that fighting the market can be a very expensive lesson. The importance of knowing the direction of the general market cannot be overemphasized. A 33% loss in a portfolio of stocks requires a 50% gain just to get to your break-even point. For example, if a $10,000 portfolio is allowed to decline to $6,666, a 33% decline, the portfolio has to rise $3,333, or 50%, just to get you back where you started. You positively must always act to preserve as much as possible of the profit that you've built up during the bull market, rather than ride your investments back down through difficult bear market periods. To do this, you have to learn historically proven selling rules. Many investors like to think of, or at least describe themselves, as long-term investors. Their strategy is to stay fully invested through thick and thin. Some institutions do the same thing, but this inflexible approach can bring tragic results, particularly for individual investors. Individuals and institutions alike may get away with standing pat through relatively mild, 20% or less, bear markets. But many bear markets are not mild. Some are downright devastating. The problem always comes at the beginning, when you start to sense an impending bear market. You cannot, in every case, project how bad economic conditions might become, or how long they could linger. For example, the war in Vietnam, inflation, and a tight money supply helped turn the 1969-1970 correction into a 2-year decline of 36.9%. Before that, bear markets averaged only 9 months and took the averages down 26%. Most stocks fall during a bear market, but not all of them recover. If you hold on during even a modest bear correction, you can get stuck with damaged merchandise that may never see its former highs. You must learn to sell when the overall environment changes and your stocks are not working. Buy and hold investors fell in love with Coca-Cola during the 1980s and 1990s. The soft drink maker chugged higher year after year, rising and falling with the market, but it stopped working in 1998, along with Gillette. When the market slipped into its mild bear correction that summer, Coke followed along. 2 years later, after some of the market's most exciting gains in decades, Coke was still stuck in a downtrend. In some instances, these kinds of stocks may come back, but this much is certain. Coke investors missed huge advances in names such as America Online and Qualcomm. The buy-and-hold strategy was also disastrous to anyone who held technology stocks in 2000. Many high flyers lost 75% to 90% of their value, and some will never return to their prior highs. Protecting yourself from market downturns. Napoleon once wrote that never hesitating in battle gave him an advantage over his opponents, and for many years he was undefeated. In the battlefield that is the stock market, there are the quick and there are the dead. After you see the first definite indications of a market top, don't wait around. Sell quickly before real weakness develops. When market indices peak and begin major downside reversals, you should act immediately by raising 25% or more cash, selling your stocks at market prices. Use of limit orders, buying or selling at a specific price, as opposed to a market order, which is bought or sold at market prices, is not recommended. The thing to focus on is your ability to get in or out of a stock when you need to. By quibbling over an eighth or quarter point, or their decimal equivalents, you could miss your opportunity to buy or sell a stock. Lightning-fast action is even more critical if your stock account is on margin. If your portfolio is fully margined, with half of the money in your stocks borrowed from your broker, a 20% decline in the price of your stocks will cause you to lose 40% of your money. A 50% decline in your stocks could wipe you out. In the final analysis, there are only two things you can really do when a new bear market begins: sell and get out, or go short. When you get out, you should stay out until the bear market is over. This usually means 5 or 6 months, but in the prolonged, problem-ridden 1969-1970 and 1973-1974 periods, it meant 2 years. In addition, the bear market that began in March 2000, during the last year of the Clinton administration, lasted longer and was more severe than normal. 9 out of 10 investors lost a lot of money, particularly in high-tech stocks. It was the end of a period of many excesses during the late 1990s. It was a decade where America got careless and let its guard down. Selling short can be profitable, but it's a very difficult and highly specialized skill that should only be attempted during bear markets. But be forewarned, few people make money shorting. If stop-loss orders are used or mentally recorded and acted upon, a market that is starting to top out will mechanically force you, robot-like, out of many of your stocks. A stop-loss order instructs the specialist in the stock on the exchange floor that once the stock drops to your specified price, it then becomes a market order and will be sold out on the next transaction. It's usually better not to enter stop-loss orders. In doing so, you and other similarly minded investors are showing your hand to market makers. At times, they might drop the stock to shake out stop-loss orders. Instead, watch your stocks closely and know ahead of time the exact price at which you will immediately sell to cut a loss. However, some people travel a lot and aren't able to watch their stocks closely. Others have a hard time making sell decisions and getting out when they are losing. In such cases, stop-loss orders help protect against distance and indecisiveness. If you use them, remember to cancel the stop-loss order if you change your mind and sell a stock before the stop-loss order is executed. Otherwise, you could later accidentally sell a stock you no longer own. Such errors can be costly. To detect a market top, keep a close eye on the daily S&P 500, Dow 30, and NASDAQ Composite as they work their way higher. On one of the days in the uptrend, volume for the market as a whole will increase from the day before, but the average itself will show stalling action. Significantly less price increase for the day compared to the prior day's price increase. I call this heavy volume without further price progress up. The average doesn't have to close down for the day, but in most instances it will, making it much easier to see the distribution, selling, as professional investors liquidate stock. The spread from the average's daily high to its daily low may be a little wider than on previous days. Normal liquidation near the market peak will usually occur on 3 to 5 days, over 1, 2, or 3 weeks. In other words, the market comes under distribution while it is advancing. This is one reason so few people know how to recognize distribution. After 4 or 5 days of definite distribution, the general market will almost always turn down. 4 days of distribution, if correctly spotted over a 2 or 3 week period, are often enough to turn a previously advancing market into a decline. Sometimes distribution can be spread over 6 or 7 weeks if the market attempts to rally back to new highs. If you miss the topping signals given off by the S&P 500, NASDAQ, or Dow, which is easy to do since they sometimes occur on only a few days, you could be wrong about the market direction and therefore wrong on almost everything you do. One of the biggest problems is the time it takes to reverse investors' positive personal opinions and views. If you sell and always cut all losses, 7% or 8% below your buy points, you will automatically be forced into selling at least some stocks,